Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that is the Ames Brothers. U-U-U hit number one on the singles charts on this day in 1953 for our musical interlude Days in History. We are joined now as we look at the climate march that took place last weekend and last week, the largest in the history of the United States. The climate conference took place with President Obama at the United Nations with three activists in the climate change world. Jacqueline Patterson joins us once again, director of the NAACP Climate Justice Initiative. Brenton Mock is justice editor for Grist, where he writes regularly about the environmental justice issues and connections between environmental policy, race, and politics. And Mike Tidwell, founder and director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network and author of The Ravaging Tide, The Strange Weather, Future Katrinas, and The Race to Save America's Coastal Cities. And Jackie, Brenton, and Mike, welcome. Good to have the three of you with us.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
And you all can join us at 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at talk@steinershow.org, log on to our Facebook pages, or you can tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. So this was a momentous march, and I have a lot of questions, but Jackie Patterson, I know you were, all of you have been deeply involved. Talk about, from your perspective, the significance of this particular day and this series of things you took part in New York City.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
So first off, thank you for having me on. And, the significance, there was a lot, particularly around the events that came in and around the march. The march was an opportunity in and of itself to bring together folks from all walks of the struggle to really come together and unite around the central message that we need to urgently take action on climate change. So just the sheer kind of breadth of folks coming together was significant, from the grannies, I forget their full name, but it was grannies something something, to mental health professionals who recognize the mental health issues here, to various children's groups like Kids Versus Global Warming, to and labor, teachers, all these different folks really coming together was huge and significant. And what I thought was important was the events that were surrounding the march, because I would actually have a bit of skepticism and concern about the thousands of the millions of dollars and the thousands of people hours that were devoted to bringing folks together for a day that would fade in the news cycle pretty quickly. So I was concerned about that level of effort to do that. You know, as much as it's important to bring folks together and exciting to bring folks together and important to raise this issue, I was worried about a cost-benefit analysis. But to me, what made it more valuable was the fact that we had all these other events around it. The Systems Change Net, Climate Change, Climate Convergence, the Climate Justice Alliance, People's Climate Summit, where folks came together not only just to march and raise awareness, but also to talk together about ways that we can do movement building together going forward.
Brenton, the same quick question to you and then to Mike, just your sense of what was there and what it was like being there and what you thought was significant. Brenton?
So I wasn't in New York.
Well, fine.
For the march. But that's okay. I was there in spirit.
Right, so was I.
I think I had a prior engagement in the other cities. And it should be noted that while the main event was in New York City, that a lot of people staged events and had their own ways of honoring the spirit of it in their own cities around the nation, right? And in some ways, I was even encouraged, kind of like with, you know, with Earth Day 1970, where it was, more so during Earth Day 1970, where they actually did encourage people to do things in their own communities as opposed to try to have a big centralized thing. But while the main event was in New York City, there were also events held around the nation. And that even falls in line with environmental concerns, right? Because, you know, I know a lot of people were concerned about the carbon footprint of a bunch of people flying and busing into to one place. But all of that aside, I think that the visual of so many people, I believe estimated 400,000 coming together for that march was undeniably powerful. I don't know that any march really in recent time has brought together so many people for one particular cause. You know, other than, you know, the Occupy demonstrations. But, you know, it was really, I mean, it was monumental. I think it was disappointing that that the TV news coverage, particularly cable TV news coverage, seemed to just completely, you know, ignore it. You know, I mean, literally you have thousands of people outside of 30 Rock and, you know, no one thought to put a camera out there.
Right.
So it was really interesting. But I'm more interested in what happens after the march, you know, as my friend Jackie was talking about. I mean, there was the People's Climate Summit, which happened the days after at the New School, and then the work on the ground continues as it did before the march. And, you know, I think it's really important that that resources are dedicated to people who will continue to be doing this work way beyond just the main event.
So, and very quickly, Mike, your thoughts, because the real specific questions about the issues of what comes next and other things that have come up. Mike?
Thanks, Mark, for having me on your show.
Always good to have you.
I was there. I marched. It was an amazing thing. I think that a lot of positive benefits are going to come out of this. One, those 400,000 people who were there, they're going back to their local communities totally fired up. The level of creativity, the chanting, the singing, the waving, the students, the nurses, the old people, the young people, gay, straight, theist, non-theist, you name it, they were all there. It was just amazing. America was there in New York, and it's reverberating across the world. I mean, people are taking notice in the world's capitals elsewhere that 400,000 people came together. And in recent memory, I think only the immigration rallies of immigration reform rallies of 2006 had bigger crowds than this in recent memory. So it takes a really big movement to get 400,000 people in one place, and those 400,000 people are all going home even more fired up. We have to keep pressure on Barack Obama, on John Kerry, to push for a real agreement in Paris a year from December, and that's what this is all leading to, is a treaty in 2015 to replace an agreement. They may not even call it a treaty, but an agreement to replace Kyoto. And I think we made a great first step with this historic rally in New York last Sunday.
So let me ask a question about this. And folks, I'd love you to join us if you were there. If you weren't there, wherever you're listening to us from, 410-319-8888. You can also just write to me here at talk@steinershow.org. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what you saw, what you heard, what you think about where we're going now. But let's do talk about what you both just said, all three just said. About what comes from here. It was a huge march. There were thousands of demonstrations across the country and across the globe. There were 30,000 people in London as well marching in solidarity with this march in New York. So there was an energy there, indigenous people, people of color, old and young, all kinds of folks turning out. Unions turned out in larger degree than they ever have before in a climate march. But I think it just does still lend itself to, so the march was great. People felt good. You just said a moment ago, Mike, you felt people were energized to go back. But let's talk about what that really means. I mean, and what people really have to confront in their daily lives, organizing, given the power of gas and oil, despite the Rockefeller Foundation saying they're going to pull out their money from carbon-based investments, but it's going to be a slow pullout. You know, this is a very difficult task that we're facing. So, I mean, and you have things like the Wall Street Journal article that's coming out, giving facts that kind of make people question what's really going on. So where do we go from here? Jackie, what do you?
Yeah. So, I participated in a small, quiet conversation that was put together by the Quakers actually, on Wednesday before leaving New York. And we were talking about what it's going to really take to turn things around, and talking about how we celebrated what happened on Sunday, but in a way it was kind of it was a gathering of the already willing. I mean, I don't think we saw necessarily any new converts getting out there on the streets, although I can't really say amongst the 400,000. There might have been people who were on the sidelines before but joined in, and that's significant and fantastic. But we were talking about how we can really make sure that we're talking across the lines. One of the things that the Quakers do is that they have conversations with folks who are traditionally either climate deniers or have other interests in terms of not being able to or willing to support aggressive climate legislation. And so I think we need to have more of those conversations, more listening between these various, you know, people who are fairly opposed, so that we can really find more common ground. So to me, that's the group that gathered, we thought that was significant in terms of what needs to be done. But then, you know, we also need to, I mean, that to me isn't necessarily all, but I think that's an element that we're not paying enough attention to, in addition to all the other things that we're doing, which I think are significant, trying to reduce, you know, subsidies, shutting down bad facilities, all the things that we're already doing as a movement. That's an element that we thought was missing. So
yeah, I'd like to pick up on that, Mike, a little bit. I mean, one of the things that, you know, you look, whether it's here in Maryland with the LNG facility, liquid natural gas facility, that looks like it's going to be built. The power of the gas industry, with America's gas industry being so really overwhelming power internationally, it's been, some people have written about, though not many, about the relationship between their lobbying and Ukraine policy, down to the whole issue of pipelines and we becoming the Saudi Arabia of gas. I mean, there's a lot there, and people have jobs. There's tens of thousands of jobs involved. So it's a very frightening thing for a lot of people.
Well, again, you don't get 400,000 people together in one place if you don't have a powerful national movement. The reality is the climate, clean energy, climate justice movement is big. We have arrived. Sunday was our coming out. You know, again, you just can't get that many people with a small movement. So we have a big movement, but we still need to grow. We are winning. I mean, the reality is we are winning. The advocates for clean energy, the movement for clean energy is winning. How do we know? Because solar and wind prices are plummeting. Wind is outcompeting gas in the Midwest right now. Solar is outcompeting gas in parts of Minnesota and elsewhere. We're not there yet. Fracking has brought new dangerous form of fossil fuel into the market, but you see a massive resistance to fracking as well. A huge, huge part of the march on Sunday was made up of tens and tens and tens of thousands of people opposed to tar sands and opposed to fracking. That movement is a social interjection into these market forces, and I think that you're going to see certainly a lot less fracking than would happen otherwise. The whole idea of exporting gas has been made hugely controversial. If they're able to export any, it's not going to be as much as they want. And you're going to see, again, wind and solar overtaking these, you know, 19th century radical forms of extreme energy, and the transition is happening. The question is, can we make it happen fast enough? I think we can, but we have to keep growing as a movement. You'll see in Maryland, for example, this year in the 2015 General Assembly, a bill that I believe is going to pass that will double the mandate for wind and solar in the statewide grid. So that bill is going to have a lot of support. The Ecumenical Leaders Council in Maryland endorsed a doubling of wind and solar for the clean electricity standard in Maryland. On the day of the march last Sunday, they issued a statement saying that they support that in Maryland. You're going to see lots of support in the next few weeks, and we're going to do it. And we're just moving on our way. We just have to pick it up.
And Brenton, your thoughts on how you think, if you take that, extrapolate it out, and I want to go to Jackie with this as well, this whole idea that that you talked about where we have to take it from here, you said the visual of so many people was amazing, but it has to take the next step. And for you, what is that next step?
Well, everything is going to come back to voting. You know, like, tax credits are great, and getting more wind and solar to the market is great. You know, everything that, you know, stopping fracking, all of that, you know, the signs and the posters that people put up about ending fracking and then putting an end to fossil fuels. And, you know, again, like the visual of that is great, if for no other reason that the rest of the world, you know, who probably thinks that the United States has been sleeping on climate issues, they got to see that, and they got to see, well, okay, so maybe the United States is a little bit more pumped up on this than we thought. It's actually the people in government who are asleep at the wheel. But it's the people in government who are asleep at the wheel who will ultimately have to pull these levers, right? And so it's going to come back to voting. And so when you talk about what's next, one of the biggest challenges of the climate justice movement is that they have to, you know, they really have to start connecting these dots in terms of the protections that are being lost with voting rights, helping understand the impact of gerrymandering, not only across the nation, but within states and within communities, and how that really helps to perpetuate the kind of power that's in government right now, that's allowing fossil fuels to continue to rule the market. And the sooner that we start, you know, making those stronger connections, I think the movement could really start to get some acceleration.
And I think, Jackie Patterson, this is the point. I think the things that you've been working on and others have been working on the country, and that part of the way that movement has to begin to move and change is that the literal face of the movement is also changing. I mean, we always thought the environmental movement as a large mass of young white student activists, young white activists. But that's changing. We have 2 minutes to break. I want you to start that, Jackie. I'll come right back to you after the break. But talk a bit about that, because, I mean, that is where you saw it in this march. Things were afoot.
Yes, that is absolutely true. And I think that we're starting to have some of those tough conversations and tough engagements that are going to get us there. It was a long, tension-filled struggle to get to the point where they actually were very intentional about having the frontline communities at the very front of the march. And we need to really replicate that in the movement itself. And I think it's going to be a struggle to get there, but I think we are moving in that direction.
So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to examine that and look at some of the issues that were raised because of this march, what people thought about the climate summit taking place in New York internationally with President Barack Obama, and more with our three guests, Jacqueline Patterson, Brenton Mock, Mike Tidwell, and you at 410-319-8888. We're going to go to break here with the West Side Story. The musical debuted on this day in 1957 in New York. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Oh, no. That's not true.
Puerto Rico, my heart's devotion, let it sink back in the ocean. Always the hurricanes blowing, always the population growing, and the money owing, and the sunlight streaming, and the natives steaming. I like the island Manhattan.
I know you do.
Disco hit, Turn the Beat Around. Vicki Sue Robinson released this in 1975 on this day in history. We are here joined by Jackie Patterson, director of the NAACP Climate Justice Initiative, Brenton Mock, justice editor for Grist, Mike Tidwell, founder and director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, and you at 410-319-8888. So two things in the time we have together here that I really want to come back to. And picking up where we left off, Jackie, at the break, which is this question about the changing face of the movement, the environmental justice movement, the movement that's happening in indigenous communities, what's happening in Appalachia, the kind of distance you feel but changing in a lot of African-American communities in urban America, coming to the realization that this movement affects everyone and they most of all in some ways. So talk about how you see that change taking place.
Oh, back to me again.
Yeah. Then we'll go around the room. I just want to start with you.
Okay, sure. No, thank you. I think one thing is that with regard to the African-American community, to some extent, the movement has already been happening within the African American community. What we're seeing some shift around is the merging of what's happening in the grassroots community, not African American, Latino, Indigenous, and so forth, with the more public facing movement that has up until now been led by Big Greens. So folks have been kind of in the trenches dealing with issues, even if they're not necessarily named around climate change. So whether it's disaster justice related to Katrina or whether it's what's previously been named and still environmental justice as it relates to coal plants that are polluting communities, all of this is, you know, or even food justice in terms of food deserts that folks are dealing with. So in some ways, folks have been fighting these struggles. But now I think we're seeing for sure with the failure of comprehensive climate legislation, first of all, the flawed design of comprehensive climate legislation in the first place, and then its eventual failure and a lack of engagement in communities of color and low-income communities in its formation, not to mention its support and advancement. So that's all to say that that we're seeing more folks coming to the table, more folks, as you say, recognizing the impacts, more broadening of the definition of climate justice so that it encompasses all of these different efforts that are leading us towards climate justice but weren't previously named so. More of an emphasis on human and civil rights in the climate justice movement as opposed to kind of a traditional environmentalism type of frame. And as a result, we're seeing more coming together. And again, like I said before, we do need to work through the tensions around kind of the Big Green's dominance of the framing, the messaging, and the demands of the movement and more of a putting up front the frontline communities' issues and demands as well. Thank you.
Yeah, no, thanks, Jackie. And Brenton, I mean, I think that you cover this. So I'm curious what you see bubbling up that we don't see.
I mean, in terms of what's bubbling up. I mean, I think that in general, when we talk about the changing face of the movement, I think we have to kind of be careful. I mean, when we talk about diversity, if we keep it as a paint by number kind of thing, right? Where it's we look at the march and we say, oh well, there was 20% black people and 15% Native Americans.
Right.
Then it becomes a really superficial thing. I think true diversity, or rather the kind of diversity that makes climate change matter and anti-climate change policies actually have meaning, immediate meaning for all people and benefits for all people, means, really incorporating in these fights against racism, these fights against sexism, understanding the interconnections between what happens with the kinds of companies that contribute to climate change and how they also contribute to disenfranchisement, how they also contribute to unequal pay for women, how they also contribute to not paying fair wages to people. I mean, you look throughout the South, the states that Jackie compiled in the NAACP's climate change report. When you look at the states that are not distributing equal benefits from the renewable energy sector and the clean energy sector, those states are in the South. Those are the states where you have huge African American populations, where you have growing Latino populations. These are non-union stations. These are states where it's sometimes the most dangerous to work because you don't get a lot of OSHA protection. And so, I mean, these are the kinds of things that I think substantiate diversity beyond just, a crowd that looks pretty with a lot of different colors. And I think that there are definitely coalitions and groups, Climate Justice Alliance, definitely groups like the group that Sierra Club and NAACP are a part of. I'm losing it right now. I'm open.
That's all right.
Yeah, but there are groups that are banding together and making these connections because they understand that it can't really just be about going out to the pipeline, Keystone Pipeline, and putting up a no fracking sign. That eventually that they have to merge these different movements for there really for there to be real acceleration.
And Mike, let's talk a bit about that too. And I'm not being when I say these things like a naysayer. I just sometimes look at kind of harsh realities that we face in struggles to save this earth and to build a new way of life, because that's what we're tantamount to talking about when we're facing a kind of what's been said by some studies, a $1.1 trillion business in America that affects a million jobs or more. Some people argue, some say less, some say more, and high wages. I mean, this is something, and we get in our cars every day and turn on the engine, turn on our air conditioners. What I'm saying is this is not as simple a task as pushing for laws to change a bit of the grid. You know what I'm saying? So I mean, this is a huge peace that a huge war we're facing in some ways. For want of a better term.
Climate change affects everybody. It's already affecting everybody. Sandy, Katrina. It never rains in California anymore. It's just stopped raining. It affects our agriculture. Sea level rises, wreaking havoc on places like Norfolk, Virginia. If you want to talk huge, the impacts are huge right now already. And it affects everyone. I mean, the Congressional Black Caucus has done multiple studies showing that African Americans are being affected tremendously by climate change already and are disproportionately affected compared to Caucasian Americans. The Labor Sustainability Network, run by Joe Uline, a great Maryland former union leader that you've had on your show. Joe's group did a study recently that showed that laborers, working people, are disproportionately affected by climate change and will be dramatically affected more moving forward, because when it's really, really hot, it is hard to do any kind of outdoor labor and the kind of labor that's created the middle class in this country. So everybody's affected. It's huge impact. So when you point to the huge fossil fuel industry and all their money and how we're all complicit in our cars, I think everyone gets that. We understand it's a big struggle, but we've overcome big struggles in the past, and we're going to overcome this struggle. The question is, how quickly can we get going? And I think that's why the 400,000 people in New York was a good sign. And I will say this, cap and trade was a bad idea. It collapsed because it was unfair. It rewarded the polluters and penalized the middle class, and it is gone. It is politically dead. So what's going to come after it? As a national policy to address this international crisis, and I firmly believe it won't be something called a carbon tax, but it will be something like what Maryland Congressman Chris Van Hollen just introduced in July. It's a bill called the Family Security and Prosperous Climate Act. And what it does is it puts a cap on carbon pollution in a really transparent way to the first sellers of carbon, so the first people who bring the coal up from the ground or offload the oil from a tanker or frack the gas. When you try to bring it to market, you have to have a permit. You have to pay for it. Those permits are going to get fewer and fewer based on the scientific reductions we need. Now, what do you do with the permit money? Chris Van Hollen's bill rebates all of it to every American in an equal share. So you will get a monthly carbon refund check, starting, $100 in the early years and moving up to thousands of dollars as we decarbonize the economy. It does it in a progressive way, and 80% of Americans either make more money or break even despite the rising fuel costs that will come under this bill. So there's a very creative idea out there that protects the middle class, helps 80% of Americans that come out ahead despite phasing out fossil fuels and phasing out these companies. So it can be done. I think we now have a legislative strategy, and we have a movement that's growing to match that strategy, I believe.
And finally, our last minute, Jackie, I know you have a lot of work to do out there, but I think the next time we talk, I think it's important to talk about how we organize and connect people to make this heard. When you see things like the Wall Street Journal editorial that was printed, and even though it was done by deniers and also folks who are fueled by the oil industry, it's something that places like Fox TV put up and put in people's consciousness about what's going on. And I think so. There's a lot of work ahead. So I know you're in part of the leadership of that. And when we join each other next time, we're going to kick off on that and get people from around the country to talk about what they're doing to organize together.
Great. Thank you.
I want to thank the three of you. It's been always great to have three of you here. Wish we could have been there Sunday, but we were at a funeral here in Baltimore, so we could not go, but we were there in heart and spirit. Jackie Patterson is director of the NAACP's Climate Justice Initiative. Brenton Mock, justice editor for GRIST. Mike Tidwell is the founder and director of Chesapeake Climate Action Network and author of Ravaging Tide, The Strange Weather, Future Katrinas, and the Race to Save America's Coastal Cities. Thank the three of you so much for taking time with our listeners today.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you all. We can take a brief break and come back and let you know that I think of one of my favorite signs in that march was, if the climate were a bank, it would have been saved. We're going out of here with Blueberry Hill by the great Fats Domino, entered the charts on this day in 1954. When we come back, we talk about Eric Holder's resignation. Stay with us.
Yeah.